platform, the Nintendo 64. Yet all the while, id had developed the enigmatic reputation of being staunchly independent. "I don't think you'll be able to pull off buying id," Alex wrote back to Gates, "but Doom could certainly be valuable to us." Alex had been addicted to id's games ever since Wolfenstein 3D hit the Microsoft campus in 1992. Doom was being played so frequently around the company that he equated it with a religious phenomenon. Microsoft's employees worshipped the game, not only for its addictive qualities, but for its enviable technical feats. The buzzword in the industry was multimedia, and no one had seen a multimedia display for the computer quite as impressive as Doom. Since Microsoft was embarking on a battle to rule the emerging age of multimedia with its new operating system, Windows 95, Alex thought it was time to enlist Doom in the fight. But a game, as he knew, was far from his boss's idea of what multimedia really meant. In Gates's mind, multimedia meant video. Apple was gaining ground with its QuickTime video playing software, and Gates wanted Microsoft to respond with a similar program. Alex didn't agree with this direction. The real multimedia applications of the future, he argued, were in games. Another competitor, Intel, he pointed out, was pursuing its own solutions, and if Microsoft wanted to maintain its foothold, it needed to prove that Windows 95 would be the best game platform in the business. Earlier attempts at games for Windows, however, had left Gates with a bad taste. For Christmas, 1994, the company had shipped a game based on Disney's The Lion King with 1 million Compaq computers. At the last moment, Compaq had changed its hardware, which caused the million games to trigger a million system crashes. The problem, Alex surmised, was that there was no technical solution that would allow a game in all its multimedia splendor to play safely and effectively on a variety of machines. As a result, game developers were steering clear of Windows in favor of DOS, the old operating system that Microsoft was trying to put out to pasture. If Microsoft was going to convince the masses to upgrade to Windows 95, it needed the game developers to come on board. So in early 1995, Alex and his team developed a technology that made sure a game would run on Windows no matter how a computer's hardware might change. The technology was called DirectX. With DirectX, developers could make games without having to worry about a Lion King-like fiasco, and, in turn, pledge their support to Windows. But Alex knew that game developers were a highly skeptical bunch. There was no better way to convince them to use this new technology, he figured, than to show them a version of Doom running on Windows with DirectX. Id, he quickly discovered, was less than interested in taking on the job of programming a Windows version of Doom. The company had already turned away Apple and IBM because Carmack didn't want to spend time doing ports. And Doom was already running fine on DOS and being played by plenty of people, so why bother? Furthermore, Carmack, long an advocate of giving away source code for the greater good of the technology, seemed almost disdainful of Microsoft's proprietary stance. Alex assured him that id would not have to lift a finger. Microsoft would port the game itself. Carmack agreed. WinDoom, as the version was called, was showcased at the Game Developers Conference in Silicon Valley in March 1995. Microsoft spared no expense, renting out the Great American Theme Park to unveil its goods. As the lights dimmed in the auditorium, the audience of gamers began chanting, "DOS! DOS! DOS!" in defense of Microsoft's established platform for games. But, as WinDoom began playing on the large screen, a hush of reverence fell over the crowd. The age of Windows and DirectX had begun. The next and most formidable step was to come, selling Windows as a gaming platform to the public. Despite Doom's success, most casual gamers still viewed computers as geeky things, full of weird bugs and cryptic command requirements that plagued DOS games. Now was the key moment, Alex knew, for Microsoft to put up or shut up. On the strength of the WinDoom demo, he had managed to enlist several companies to create games for Windows 95 using DirectX. They just needed to make a big splash in time for Christmas 1995. With a demonic game like Doom as its showcase, what better way to make a splash than a Halloween media event? It would be a bash like no other, filled with hundreds of reporters from gaming to mainstream publications. This would be their chance to see what Microsoft was all about in the multimedia age. The event would be called, appropriately, Judgment Day. Alex couldn't have called id about the party at a better time. The company had just brought on a new colleague who was the epitome of a party guy, Mike Wilson. A childhood friend of Adrian Carmack's from Shreveport, the 24-year-old had finished his stint working with Dwango Bob. The rise of the internet had put an end to Dwango's spree. Gamers had no reason to pay to play when they could do it for free online. But for Mike, life was a party that never died. With long blonde hair and a surfer's ease, he was a free spirit who had done everything from manage a daiquiri bar to sell Jesus wallets in a local country and western store. Though he wasn't a big gamer, he could see that games were the new rock and roll, and the guys at id the new rock stars. Mike loved the idea of Judgment Day. Alex was going to convert Microsoft's cafeteria and garage into a sprawling haunted mansion. More than 30 of the biggest game developers, including Activision, LucasArts, and id, would be invited to create their own sections of the mansion. Mike's eyes widened, imagining what demonic fun id could have with such an assignment. Why not invite the top Doom gamers from around the world for a giant deathmatch tournament, the first ever to be held right at the show? The plan was set. "It's now official," Mike declared in a press release. "We are leading Microsoft down the highway to hell." Alex didn't have much trouble connecting with Mike's devilish attitude. Despite all his work on DirectX, he still felt like Microsoft was treating his project as skunk work. On one occasion, he received a call from an incredulous superior who simply said, "Tell me why I shouldn't fire you." Judgment Day would show them all the answer. But to succeed, he knew that he needed to unveil not only the games, but the man himself, Bill Gates. Alex's requests to feature the CEO at the Halloween event, not surprisingly, were turned down. Gates had other things to do, he was told. But Alex persisted and managed to persuade Gates's public relations lackeys at least to have him record a video address for the crowd. On the day of the shoot, Gates met Alex in the Microsoft video studio, flanked by anxious PR representatives who began dictating how the shoot was going to proceed. Gates, noticing Alex's clear dismay, cut them off. "So, what do I need to do for this video?" Gates asked. Alex took a deep breath. Then, he handed Gates a shotgun. Halloween came one night early at Microsoft, on October 30th, 1995. The party was in full swing. A Ferris wheel spun outside. A circus tent offered beer and barbecue. A three-story-tall makeshift volcano bubbled up red light. Over at the microphone, Jay Leno, master of ceremonies for the night, entertained the crowd. But the real action was happening underground, in the garage that had been converted into a haunted mansion. There, the deathmatch competition Mike Wilson had organized was underway. 20 elite gamers had been flown in and were competing under a giant screen that showed the game. The two top contenders, a stealth Asian-American teenager nicknamed Thresh and a Floridian beach bum nicknamed Murloc, twitched over their PCs as they fought. The crowd gathered around them, cheering and taunting. Thresh won the match and was besieged by fans and reporters. "Oh my God," Jay Wilbur said to himself, looking on in disbelief. "This is a sport." Alex St. John, dressed as Satan, was busy chasing Mike Wilson through the red lights and fog. He found him in a corner, sucking down beers with one gamer dressed as Jesus and another as the Pope. Mike and his wife came as the blood-soaked anti-heroes of the movie Natural Born Killers. Alex told them that he had seen the id installation and he thought it was hilarious. But, he said, Microsoft's PR people were less than pleased. How were the press, or for that matter, the Microsoft execs, going to react? As the media and execs started making their way through the mansion, the displays seemed innocent enough. Activision was promoting an adventure game called Pitfall Harry, and had built a little jungle scene in which passers-by could swing on a makeshift vine. In another room, a company called Zombie had a metal sphere that shot blue electric bolts through the air. But the id installation had a bit more in store. An 8-foot-tall vagina. Gwar, the scatological rock band that id had hired to produce the display, had pushed their renowned prurient theatrics to the edge. The vagina was lined with dozens of dildos to look like teeth. A bust of O.J. Simpson's decapitated head hung from the top. As the visitors walked through the vaginal mouth, two members of Gwar, cloaked in fur and raw steak, came leaping out of the shadows and pretended to attack them with rubber penises. The Microsoft executives were frozen. Then, to everyone's relief, they burst out laughing. Not everyone else, however, was getting the joke. On stage, a band of Mike's friends called Society of the Damned was screeching through a dissonant set of industrial rock. No sooner had they launched into an abrasive track called Gods of Fear than the Microsoft PR people decided they'd had enough. Two security guards stormed the stage and demanded that the band members conclude their set. Alex saw the commotion and lumbered over, his face as red as his Satan costume. "These guys are the guests of id Software," he barked. "The id Software, the guys who made Doom. Any friends of id's are friends of Microsoft." But the guards weren't having it and unplugged the sound system. As the lights fell, a video screen lowered above the stage. It was time for the main event. The crowd cheered as footage of Doom's familiar corridors began to roll. But it was not the Doom soldier chasing the demons. It was Bill Gates. Microsoft's fearless leader was superimposed running inside the game in a long black trench coat and brandishing a shotgun. Gates stopped running and addressed the crowd about the wonders of Windows 95 as a gaming platform. A platform that could deliver cutting-edge multimedia experiences like Doom. But no sooner had he begun than an imp monster from the game jumped out and, through a voiceover, asked Gates for an autograph. Gates responded by raising his shotgun and blowing the beast into gory chunks. "Don't interrupt me while I'm speaking," he said, then finished his speech. At the end, the screen went black with blood, only to be replaced by the familiar Microsoft logo and the phrase, "Who do you want to execute today?" "This is it," Alex thought. "I'm going to be fired." He went to retrieve the video, but it was gone. He could keep his job, he learned. Microsoft was keeping the tape. The news was spreading fast. Subject: Romero is dead. "I heard on the newsgroup that John Romero was in a car accident. Is he okay?" Could it be? John Romero, 28-year-old ace programmer, rich person, the surgeon, dead? According to the gossip online, his fly yellow Ferrari had gone careening off some Dallas highway in one final joyride. It wouldn't have been the first ill fate of an id sports car. Just weeks earlier, a $500,000 custom Doom Porsche race car, complete with the game's logo emblazoned on the fire-red hood, being financed by Carmack and built by Bob Norwood, had been mysteriously stolen from his lot. Maybe Romero was suffering some curse. In reality, Romero was very much alive. He had just returned from inspecting the house he was having custom built, a $1.3 million, 9,000-square-foot Tudor mansion with a 6-car garage, video game arcade, and two limestone gargoyles guarding the door. Now, he was sitting at his desk in suite 666, overlooking his pristine car in the lot. The rumors were a fitting coronation, the game god equivalent of the Beatles' Paul is Dead legend. But Romero took exception to the implication that he would perish by his own ineptitude. No, I'm not dead, he wrote online in response. I don't wreck cars or myself. Not everyone in the office would agree. By November 1995, Quake was nowhere near completion, and factions were more vocally blaming Romero. With Carmack still immersed in making his engine, the rest of the company felt like they had nothing tangible to pursue. The artists, Kevin and Adrian, were tired of churning out all the fantasy textures without a clear plan. The level designers, American and Sandy, were bored twiddling around with rudimentary game sections. Beyond the basic concept of a fantasy game and a big hammer weapon, there wasn't much to go on. Whenever they asked Romero for direction, he would just spew out his generalizations and leave them to fend for themselves. What kind of project director was that? In Romero's mind, Quake was coming along just fine. Carmack was busy working on what he knew would be the next killer game program. There was no reason to rush Engine John. The rest of the company had to just be patient and get ready to throw on the great game design. The best thing they could do was find ways to be productive. Romero chose to spend this time by immersing himself inside projects that he felt would have direct benefit to the company. But he could sense that they wanted to blame him for not getting the game done, that he wasn't doing enough work. They viewed his detachment, his flipped bit, as a sign that their resident rock star was spinning, if not crashing, his wheels. Their attitude was starting to piss him off. So what if he was going home at 7 p.m.? He had a wife. He was building a home. He was making a life, and he deserved it. Now that id finally had some more employees to take up the slack, he should be able to take it easier. If the company were hurting, he could understand the complaints. But the company was doing well, in no small part thanks to his multiple projects. And if he wasn't going to oversee these projects, who was? Yet Romero was neither seeking nor finding empathy. One night, Sandy Peterson decided he had had enough. He stormed into Carmack's office and shut the door. I think John's a really good designer, he said, and I think that he's currently not properly organizing Quake. I've been at a big company where games get organized, and I know how it's done, and he's not doing it. He's not a project manager. He doesn't know how to do it, and the game's not going to come together unless he changes some things. Carmack hit the reply button in his head and spewed out what was now his rote response to this complaint. Romero works like a demon at the right time, he said, and it'll all come together. Then he spun around in his chair and went back to work. No goodbyes, no conversation ender, no nothing. Typical, Sandy thought. Carmack had long behaved this way, unconcerned with the conventional etiquette of how to begin, continue, and conclude a dialogue with another human being. But these days, it was growing worse. One afternoon, Michael Abrash told Carmack about how his daughter had finally gotten into a good school after considerable effort. It had meant a lot to Michael, but all Carmack had to say in response was, Then he spun around to his desk. Carmack could feel that he was drifting off into space, further and further away from things that he could talk about with normal people. He couldn't connect with anything that was stirring around him. The office politics, happy hours, MTV. His world was Quake. His days were Quake. His nights, his life. He was working 80-hour weeks easily, fully immersed in his nocturnal schedule. People would see him walk in, grab a Diet Coke from the fridge, then make a beeline to his office. The only action they'd see would be the occasional pizza delivery person knocking on his door. And yet, despite his best efforts, Carmack, for the first time in his life, felt like nothing was falling into place. Quake was requiring him, essentially, to reinvent everything. Little from Doom could be extended into Quake's 3D world. Doom supported four players in Deathmatch in somewhat tricky network mode, but Quake would support 16 people easily over the internet. Doom had a limited three-dimensional perspective, but Quake would deliver full-blown immersion, allowing players to look in any direction and see a convincing virtual world. The most frustrating consequence was his engine's inability to draw a complete visible world, or, in technical terms, a potentially visible set. As a result, the world of Quake was filled with holes. Carmack would be running down a hallway of the game, only to find it abruptly end in a hideous blue void. There were blue voids in the floor, in the walls, in the ceilings. His virtual world was Swiss cheese. Consumed by this dilemma, Carmack's thoughts began getting all the more abstract. His mind filled with geometric forms, floating and spinning at his command as he tried to separate them, assemble them, organize them. He didn't dream about girls in bikinis at spring break like many guys his age. He dreamed about the relationship of two polygons in space. He would stumble home at 4 a.m. and the visions wouldn't leave him. One night he sat on the edge of his bed watching coded messages travel down to his arm, instructing it how to move, grip, release. "This isn't the way it works in real life," he thought. "I must be having a weird dream." He awoke in a cold sweat. There was no escape, not even in sleep. Though Carmack rarely felt, let alone cracked from, pressure, Quake was beginning to break him. He started lashing out at his employees. One day, Jay suggested they talk about getting software patents for their game technology. "If you guys ever apply for software patents," Carmack barked, "I quit. That's it. End of discussion." Everything grated on him. The distractions of business, the politics of emotion, the laziness, at least in his mind, of others. "You always leave early," Carmack said one evening as Sandy was walking out the door. Sandy was stunned. He was putting in 11-hour days at least, but his days started at 9 a.m., whereas Carmack didn't even get in the office until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. "I don't leave early," he said. "You're just not here when I'm here." Carmack didn't relent. He began firing off disciplinary emails. First, he banned deathmatching in the office. Then he sent out grades. Everyone in the company was given a letter grade based on his performance. Sandy got a D. Romero, a C. Carmack wasn't through. One night, he dragged his desk outside his office and planted himself to work in the hallway, the better to keep an eye on everyone around him. Employees began living in fear of their jobs and staying later and later, trying to keep up with Carmack's relentless pace. The fun, they felt, was being sucked out of the company. The tension was so thick that people started to complain about Carmack, too. Romero wasn't the only one with the ego. Carmack was off in his own world, refusing to come down. Soon, nothing, not even the most tempting distraction, could lighten the situation. One afternoon, Carmack was sitting in his office when he heard a woman's voice down the hall asking if someone had ordered a pizza. Romero replied, "No, I didn't order a pizza." She asked again, "Did you order a pizza?" Someone else said, "No." Carmack heard his door open. "Did you order a pizza?" the woman asked. He spun around to see an attractive young woman, topless, carrying a pizza box. The stripper was a practical joke arranged by Mike Wilson in an attempt to lighten the mood. "No," Carmack told her flatly. "I didn't order a pizza." Then he, too, went back to work. "Boy," the stripper said, "you guys are boring as hell." Then she walked out the door. All Carmack wanted was to be left alone to work, or, even better, just be cast adrift, left as a hermit. The only person who had any empathy for him, it seemed, was Romero. One night, Romero pulled him aside. "Dude, I know you're being hard on yourself," he said, "but you can't be superhuman." To some extent, Carmack thought, Romero was being reasonable. They could certainly work hard without requiring people to work the death schedules of the past. But Romero's attitude was indicative of something deeper, something much more telling. After all these years, all the late nights, the collaborations, Romero was pulling himself out of the trenches of code for the ether of fame and notoriety. Where was Romero when he needed him to work, experiment, lead by example, off building his mansion and being a celebrity? Carmack knew what he had to do. He had to prove that Romero was slacking, and he knew just how. He wrote a program that would create a time log whenever Romero worked on his PC. According to the results, his partner wasn't working much. When he confronted Romero with the data, his partner exploded. You're only doing that so you can fire me, Romero snapped. Well, Carmack thought, yeah. After all his speculation, Carmack now had his proof, scientific proof, that Romero was not only not working, but becoming toxic. With that evidence in hand, he didn't feel the least bit of remorse when he arrived at his conclusion. Romero needed to be warned, officially warned, to shape up. He was talking too much to the press, talking too much to fans, deathmatching too much in the office, and now the rest of the company was suffering. Carmack approached Adrian and Kevin and said, "We need to put Romero on record that he is about to be fired." Carmack had a habit of being abrupt, they knew, but this statement took them aback. "No, no, no," Adrian said. "I don't want to do that. He's a friend of mine, a partner. He'll come back around." But Carmack insisted. And, as was becoming the pattern, Kevin and Adrian did what Carmack wanted. There was no question in their minds, or the others at ID for that matter, that Engine John was their key man. As Mike Wilson said, if he takes his ball and goes home, the game's over. A meeting was called in November 1995. The owners solemnly gathered around the black conference table behind the black Venetian blinds. Carmack sat at the head of the table, as usual. "You're still not doing your work," he told Romero, "and you absolutely need to do all of this, or you're going to be fired." Romero was indignant. "I work as much as anyone else," he said. "I'm here all the time." Carmack looked to Kevin and Adrian for help, but Adrian was just staring at the floor. "Well," Kevin said in Romero's defense, "John does come in and do his work." Carmack was flabbergasted. He thought Kevin and Adrian were going to support his argument. Everyone knew that, if it came down to it, he couldn't fire Romero by himself. He needed their vote, too. For now, they agreed to give Romero a so-called smackdown bonus, a lower bonus than usual to tell him that he had to get his act together on the game. Whatever, Romero thought, he didn't need the cash right now. And when the game was finally done, he knew he'd prove them wrong. By Thanksgiving, however, nothing had changed. The game was still far off track. Carmack called another meeting, this time for the entire company. "There's no proof of concept for game design," he declared. Everyone concurred that the game was taking forever. There was no cohesive plan. American McGee finally made the inevitable suggestion to abandon Romero's ambitious idea of a hand-to-hand combat game for something more simple. "I think it will be better," he said, "if we make a game with rocket launchers and stuff like that." "Yeah," Sandy said. "Let's do Doom 3, and the next game we'll do something innovative." Romero was floored. First, the SmackDown bonus. Now this? Who the fuck were these guys? What did they know? They had never worked on a new game from start to finish. They didn't understand ID. "Every ID game proceeded just like this before," he said. "Carmack makes a revolutionary engine. Then we put a revolutionary game design on top of it. Let's just get the engine done, then we can make this really cool game idea that no one's seen before. Quake is going to be better than Doom. Even if we just slap Doom on this new engine, it'll still be a hit. We need to go beyond that and put the original great game idea that no one has done on top of this new engine and create something that's as big as Doom was when it came out." But the ball was rolling. Newer guys like American began arguing passionately against Romero's fantasy design. They felt they couldn't be creative because there was nothing to work with. There were two paths in the road. They could just stick with Carmack's technology and create a lean, mean game that could be done in a reasonable amount of time. Or they could go with Romero's design and end up God knows where. They should just do another Doom. At first, Adrian and Kevin seemed to take Romero's side. "Holy crap, guys," Adrian said. "We've done a shitload of work here." They had spent nearly a year churning out art specifically designed for a medieval fantasy, not a futuristic marine game. But after all that work, they were just getting to the fun part. putting blood on the walls, making specialized areas. Just because some of you guys haven't gotten anything done, Adrian snapped, there's no reason to scrap the project. If we switch games, it's going to take us another year to get to the point where we are right now. We're not talking about an easy change. The others didn't seem to care. As they continued to argue against Romero's ambitious design, Romero watched Carmack in disbelief. Oh my God, he realized. Carmack agrees with them. He's giving validity to the idea of not doing a revolutionary game design. Romero burst. We're already slaves to technology in this company, he said, and at least we can do what we can to make a great game on top of it like we did with Doom. Now these guys just want to slap out a game using the Doom stuff? We can still make a great game if we take the time to program it. Carmack could see both sides, but there was a key flaw in Romero's argument. He had nothing to support himself. The only workable levels of Quake that existed were the high-tech, Doom-style ones coming from American. If Romero had created an amazing fantasy world, that would have been a different story. But in Carmack's mind, Romero had done practically nothing. Clearly, their old ambitious idea for Quake, the one that went back to the lake house in Shreveport, was misguided. You have to give yourself the freedom to back away from something when you make a mistake, Carmack said. If you pretend you're infallible and bully ahead on something, even when there are many danger signs that it's not the right thing, well, that's a sure way to leave a crater in the ground. You want to always be reevaluating things and say, okay, it sounded like a good idea, but it doesn't seem to be working out very well, and we have this other avenue which is looking like it's working out better. Let's just do that. That was when it really hit Romero. We're not of a single mind anymore. We're not an agreeing entity. He couldn't believe that Carmack wasn't saying, calm down, guys. You'll see, it's going to be a badass game. As much as Carmack thought Romero had stopped being a programmer, Romero thought Carmack had stopped being a gamer. The fact that Carmack was listening to these guys showed that he was actually worried, that he didn't have the faith in the big ambitious game anymore, that he didn't have the faith in Romero. After hours of arguing, Romero threw in the towel. Okay, he said, I'll redesign the whole game with Doom-style weapons and we'll get it out. But to himself, he said something else entirely, words that echoed the statement he had uttered long ago to Carmack at Soft Disk, the day he saw their future, their destiny. This is it, he thought. I'm gone. Despite Quake's new direction and a release date that would now surely slip into 1996, id's publisher GTI cashed in heavily in December 1995. Sales for Doom 2 in the United States would eventually top the $80 million mark. The game sold overseas as well, with another $20 million from Europe, 30% of which came from Germany, a country that had banned the game from its shelves. Meanwhile, all of id's old games were continuing to sell, as were the spin-offs. Ultimate Doom, which was essentially a retail version of the Doom shareware, was bringing in over $20 million in the United States. And Raven's games, Hexen and Heretic, were doing just as well, accounting for nearly another $20 million. Buoyed by the success, GTI began striking deals with other developers, including Midway, creators of the lucrative Mortal Kombat series, the arcade magnate Williams Entertainment, and WizardWorks, a publisher of budget games. With Doom's help, computer games had skyrocketed GTA's sales from $10 million to a projected $340 million in just 2 years. When the company went public in December 1995, it was the largest venture capital-backed IPO of the year, even ahead of the internet browser company Netscape. GTI came out of nowhere to conquer a host of competitors, declared Crane's New York business, and became the country's third largest interactive entertainment company. It was valued at $638 million. But the success was by no means endearing GTI to id. When GTI offered that year to buy id for $100 million, id declined. The publisher was a shitty company, the guys thought, and they didn't want to sell id to people they didn't believe in. Furthermore, they felt too frazzled to make any kind of rational business decision. Money wasn't exactly a problem either. In 1995, id's earnings had doubled to $15.6 million, and they would surely continue to rise. With the overhead still low, the owners were each making millions. Id also thought GTI was claiming too much credit for the success of Doom 2. The guys didn't like how GTI was throwing around its money at so many other unworthy companies. At the urging of Mike Wilson, id's increasingly brash biz guy, they decided to use Quake as a way to bring GTI down. The weapon? Shareware. In most publishers' minds, by the end of 1995, shareware was a thing of the past, a cute way to distribute software that was losing its relevance in the increasingly big business of video games. So when id negotiated to retain shareware rights for Quake, GTI's Ron Chymowitz didn't think much of it. He would regret that choice. Mike pitched the id guys on a new way to capitalize on the shareware plan. Instead of just distributing Quake shareware over the internet for free, id could sell a CD-ROM containing both the shareware and an encrypted version of the full game. Someone would buy the shareware for $9.95, then could call up id directly and pay $50 for the code to unlock the complete game. As a result, id, despite not owning the retail publishing rights to Quake, could succinctly cut GTI out of the equation. Though Carmack had reservations, the rest of the company was more than eager to embark on an even more radical experiment in self-publishing. The deal was hatched. Ron Chymowitz read about it in the newspaper. Wilson, that prick, he thought. He's an immature kid who doesn't know how to deal in a professional manner. But id had every right to do the deal, even though it was not a move anyone had ever imagined. There was nothing GTI could do to stop them. As 1996 rolled around, not only was id at war with GTI, but it was at war with itself. The decision to abandon Romero's design for Carmack's technology created incinerating pressure. The company was in perpetual crunch mode, trying to get the Doom-style shooter done by March. Carmack, feeling like he was the only one running the ship, decided it was time to turn up the heat. For weeks, he had been working out in the hallway to keep an eye on everyone else. But now, he suggested they tear the walls down. The decision was made ostensibly because the company had long been talking about doubling its workspace. With the purchase of a suite next door, they could begin the remodeling right away. Carmack saw this as a key opportunity to get everyone out of isolated offices and into one big communal workspace while the renovations would be done. Reluctantly, they agreed to the new arrangement. They called it the War Room. They had no idea how messy the War Room would be. Within days, walls began crashing around them, blanketing the area in plaster dust. They lined tables up against the windows and piled on their computers, sitting by each other with barely enough room to grab a soda without knocking elbows. Carmack and Romero sat side by side. To get all their computers networked, they had to run cables through the ceiling and bust out the acoustic tiles to rope the wires down to their machines. Shades drawn, lights low, long gray cables stretching from the ceiling to their desks, it looked as though they were all sitting inside a computer's dark web of wires. There was nowhere to go without getting caught. Without the privacy of personal space, the tension began to mount. They worked 18-hour days, 7 days a week. They had to listen to their music on headphones. At any given moment, a visitor might walk in to find a room full of guys quietly typing with headphones on their ears. Romero had taken a liking to instrumental video game soundtracks, available as Japanese imports. He popped one in and bitterly slipped on his headphones. This is not the id of the past, he thought. The id of, let's make a great game together and have fun. This is the id of, shut up and work. Competition rose within the ranks. With Romero vulnerable, aspiring designer American McGee jockeyed for supremacy. But now even he had competition. Tim Willits. Tim had the distinction of being the first employee drafted from the Doom mod community. He had discovered the game while studying at the University of Minnesota. At the time, the 23-year-old was a hard-working computer science major who lived at home with his parents. His father, a pipe fitter, his mother a radiation technician. It was a competitive household, and Tim frequently butted heads with his sister, a graphics design major at the university. Short and balding, with an occasional nervous stutter, he overachieved as best he could, not only signing up for ROTC, but volunteering to slip into a life-sized rodent costume to portray the school mascot, Goldie Gopher, at football games and events. On a lark one day, Tim downloaded this game a lot of kids were talking about called Doom. Though he had played games before, he never had the sense of entering a world. But here, his actions affected the world. He could move doors, trigger buttons. He was amazed at the size of the place he had entered, the scope of this strange new universe. Tim began experimenting with the hacker-made Doom level editing programs that were floating around the bulletin board services. He started to get recognition for some of the levels he had made and uploaded. Soon enough, he got the ultimate response, an email from id. Tim was hired by American to work on the id-produced title Strife, but as Quake began to grow, he was brought in to help the team. Tim immediately aligned himself with Romero and started learning as much as he could about the art of level design. In the war room, he sat at Romero's side. He proved himself to be not only highly skilled, but highly efficient, able to complete a level design in record time. Soon Romero found himself competing just to keep up with Tim's output. Carmack immediately began to show appreciation for Tim's work. Though he still considered American his close friend, American felt left out to dry. Long enamored of Romero's rockstar lifestyle, American started living the life himself. This came after id struck a deal with Trent Reznor of the industrial rock band Nine Inch Nails, a diehard Doom fan, to provide the music and sound effects for Quake. Overseeing the project, American began to change his look, shaving his beard, styling his hair, dressing in black. He felt increasingly disconnected from Carmack, who, despite having originally approved of his work on Quake's music, now seemed only to chastise him for not spending more time making levels for the game. For American, it was the beginning of the end. Even his best friend at id, Dave Taylor, had left to pursue his own game company. American had never felt more alone. His days as id's wonder boy were over. It didn't take long to find out who had replaced him in Romero. Carmack abruptly announced one day that Tim's levels would have the coveted honor of being the opening levels of the shareware release, players' first taste of Quake. Everyone was silent in disbelief. It was an insult to Romero, who they all assumed would get that distinction. But the backlash had been coming. Since the meeting to change Quake's direction, Romero had seemed to distance himself even more from the project. "What?" Romero said. "I'm the lead designer." "That's my decision," Carmack replied. "Tim's levels are more cohesive." Romero, as always, was quick to let the bad vibes go and wished him well. As far as everyone was concerned, Carmack had just passed the torch. It was late one night in January when Romero picked up the phone in his Tudor mansion and dialed the number of Tom Hall, his ex-partner at id. The two had rekindled their friendship some months before with no hard feelings. Romero knew that Tom wasn't happy at Apogee. Tom had been running into the same old problems he'd had at id, feeling like he wasn't able to implement his own creative ideas. Apogee started doing business under the name 3D Realms, making games that would one-up id software. Their first release, Duke Nukem 3D, was in fact doing just that. The game was like a comic book version of Doom, set in a realistic, modern-day world. Players would shoot through abandoned porno theaters and strip clubs. There were even strippers. Though Carmack hated it, feeling that its engine was held together with bubblegum, the gamers bought it in droves. People were dubbing it the Quake Killer. Tom, however, was stuck working on another project for 3D Realms called Prey that was barely getting off the ground. Romero's call couldn't have come at a better time. "Dude," Romero told him, "the same thing that you ran into at id just happened to me." He explained how he had been trying to push Carmack into doing something new and creative, but Carmack just wanted to play it safe and do the same old Doom game over again. Romero had even suggested splitting the company in two, with Carmack leading a technology side and him leading a design side, but the suggestion went over with a thud. "I'm going to leave after Quake," he concluded. "What do you think about starting another company? It'll be a company where any kind of design we want to do, that's what we make. Technology has to work with our design, not the other way around. How would you like to have a company where design is law?" "That," Tom said, "would be a dream." IdSoftware.com. Login name, John C. In real life, John Carmack. Directory, Raid, Nardo, John C. Shell, Bin, CSH. Never logged in. Plan. This is my daily work. When I accomplish something, I write a star line that day. Whenever a bug/missing feature is mentioned during the day and I don't fix it, I make a note of it. Some things get noted many times before they get fixed. Occasionally, I go back through the old notes and mark with a plus the things I have since fixed. John Carmack. February 18. Star, page flip crap. Star, stretch console. Star, faster swimming speed. Star, damage direction protocol. Star, armor color flash. Star, jib death. Star, grenade tweaking. Star, brightened alias models. Star, nail gun lag. Star, dedicated server quit at game end. Plus, scoreboard. Plus, optional full size. Plus, view centering key. Plus, vid mode 15 crap. Plus, change ammo box on S bar. Plus, allow restart after a program error. Plus, respawn blood trail. Plus, -1 ammo value on rockets. Plus, light up characters. As life in the war room pressed on, Carmack took it upon himself to let gamers know that, yes, id really was moving along with its work on Quake. So he decided to upload his daily work log, or, as it was known, a .plan file, to the internet. .plan files were often used by programmers to keep each other informed of their efforts, but had yet to be exploited as a means of communicating with the masses. But id's fans had suffered months, years of Romero's unsubstantiated hyperbole, Carmack felt, and it was time that they saw some hard data. After weeks of all-nighters, Carmack and his programming partner, Michael Abrash, had finally tackled the problem of Quake's strange blue gaps. The world was coming together. Carmack would spend minutes on end just looking down into a corner of a room in the game, just walking around in the virtual world and feeling, the world is solid. It's really there. On February 24th, 1996, there was enough of Quake in place for id to upload a test deathmatch level to see how it worked on gamers' various machines. Gamers had been clamoring online for months to get a taste of id's new creation. There was so much anticipation and speculation, in fact, that websites specifically devoted to Quake news began to surface. After the test, however, the reviews were not entirely flattering. Players were keen on the prospects for deathmatching online, but complained that the game was dark, sluggish, nothing like the fast action world of Doom. The criticisms were not unfounded. These Doom-like features had had to be sacrificed in order to accommodate Quake's meticulous 3D rendering engine. But the gamers weren't sympathetic. "Well, not bad for a test version," posted one player online. "There are still many rough edges that have to be worked out. There is still a lot missing that is needed to make this game truly rule." Dejected by the response, the id team went about the laborious task of stitching together their disparate work. Over the 16 months since the game began, the level designers and artists had been off in their own worlds, and the results showed. Romero's levels looked medieval. Americans were futuristic. Sandy's were strange gothic puzzles. Though there were many staples of id's trademark dark humor, such as the zombies who would rip chunks of flesh from their asses and hurl them at the player, the game needed cohesion fast. Half-heartedly, the guys came up with a story they'd throw in Quake's manual. You get the phone call at 4 a.m. By 5:30, you're in the secret installation. The commander explains tersely, it's about the slipgate device. Once we perfect these, we'll be able to use them to transport people and cargo from one place to another instantly. An enemy codenamed Quake is using his own slipgates to insert death squads inside our bases to kill, steal, and kidnap. The hell of it is, we have no idea where he's from. Our top scientists think Quake's not from Earth, but another dimension. They say Quake's preparing to unleash his real army, whatever that is. Whatever indeed, they all felt. But the vehicle was there, and they went about inserting slipgates throughout the game, little gray static doorways that would lead players through the strange different worlds. The final months of Quake became a blur of silent and intense all-nighters, punctuated by the occasional crash of a keyboard against a wall. The construction had turned the office into a heap. The guys were taking their frustrations out by hurling computer parts into the drywall like knives. Even good press couldn't boost their spirits. Wired descended on the office for its highest honor, a cover story on id. But the guys could have cared less, showing up 3 hours late for the photo session. The cover showed Carmack in front of Romero and Adrian, staring into strange colored light, with the headline, The Egos at id. The story ordained Quake the most anticipated computer game of all time. By June, the endless days and nights finally gave way to a finished product. But the occasion of uploading the shareware to the internet barely resembled the glory days of Wolfenstein 3D and Doom. When Romero showed up to ready the game on Saturday, June 22, 1996, he was alone. He walked down the halls, past the old id awards, the Freddy Krueger mask, the Doom plastic shotgun. So it had come to this. No Carmack. No Adrian. No Kevin. Romero took refuge with the fans, heading into a gamer's chat room that teemed with id fans. He phoned Mark Fletcher, a Doom addict who had become one of Romero's friends. He wanted someone there with him that night who really understood the games, who would appreciate this moment. At 5 p.m., he tapped the button on his keyboard and sent Quake to the world. It felt weird, he thought, that none of the other guys were here with him, but it all added up. They weren't gamers. They didn't even play games anymore. They were broken. Okay, Carmack said, we can't put it off any longer. Shortly after Quake's release, he sat in a Mexican restaurant called Tia's, having lunch with Adrian and Kevin. Romero's time was up. He was clearly not pulling his weight. It was time to let him go. The thought made Adrian physically sick. This is Romero we're talking about. But he knew he was at a crossroads. Either Romero was going to have to leave, or Carmack was going to dissolve the company. There was no middle ground. Kevin agreed. It was hard to let someone go, especially given that Romero was one of the founders of the company, someone who'd contributed so much to their success. But there was no alternative. The chasm between Carmack and Romero was too wide. Both of them had their views of what it meant to make games and how games should be made. Carmack thought Romero had lost touch with being a programmer. Romero thought Carmack had lost touch as a gamer. Carmack wanted to stay small. Romero wanted to get big. The two visions that had once forged this company were irreparably tearing it apart. And though Adrian and Kevin had on so many occasions sympathized with Romero's goals, they had once and for all to choose which John to follow. Romero, unbeknownst to them, was making plans of his own. On his way to work that morning, he had dialed up Ron Chimowitz at GTI to discuss a possible publishing deal for the company he wanted to start with Tom Hall. This wasn't going to be any ordinary game company, he said. This was going to be a big company, unrestrained by technology. Design would be law. The next day at id, Romero was beckoned to the conference room. Carmack, Adrian, and Kevin sat around the table. Adrian stared at the floor. Kevin was silent. Carmack finally spoke. We're still not happy with how everything's going, you know, he said. He reached for a piece of paper and handed it to Romero. This is your resignation. You can sign it. Romero, despite all the warnings, all his plans, felt nothing but shock. Wait, he said. Don't you mean a year ago that I wasn't working? Because these last 7 months I've been killing myself. I've been killing myself to make Quake. No, Carmack said. You're not doing your work. You're not living up to your responsibilities. You're hurting the project. You're hurting the company. You've been poisonous to the company, and your contribution has been negative over the past couple years. You needed to do better, and you didn't. Now you need to go. Here's a resignation, and here's a termination. You're going to resign now. I don't want to be here, Adrian thought, staring more deeply into the carpet. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. Despite the fact that both Carmack and Romero were each somewhat justified, he knew there was no way out. But then, everything stopped. Romero fell quiet. Deep inside him, the bit began to flip, as it had so many times in his life. He would not let this get him down, just like he hadn't let anything else. His father, his stepfather, his own broken families, and now his own broken company. I was making plans to go start a company with Tom anyway, he reminded himself. I guess I'll go now. He wasn't bowing out from a fight. He was starting his new life. Romero signed the form, handed it to Carmack, and headed out. By the time Romero got to the door, Carmack assumed his ex-partner had convinced himself that he had been planning on doing this for a long time, that he had been stifled creatively and was off to bigger and better things. In the space of 40 feet, he thought, Romero had redesigned history. Carmack didn't watch him go with sadness or nostalgia. He watched him go with relief. 2 days later, Romero posted his first and last dot plan file at id. I'm going to jump on this dot plan bandwagon just this once, he wrote for all the world to read online. I have decided to leave id Software and start a new game company with different goals. I won't be taking anyone from id with me. The next day, Carmack posted a dot plan file of his own. Romero is now gone from id, he typed. There will be no more grandiose statements about our future projects. I can tell you what I am thinking and what I am trying to accomplish, but all I promise is my best effort. The old death matches were over. A new one had begun. Chapter 13. Deathmatch. In a dark room pulsing with blood-red shadows, Stevie Killcreek Case sat at her computer, twitching her body as if she were repeatedly and intentionally sticking her toe in a light socket. Don't! She yelped, leaping her soldier on the screen through a static-filled teleporter gate, only to see him rematerialize in an unanticipated blizzard of nails. Or, as she described the style of this particular death, telefragged. It was January 1997, minutes away from the online gaming underground's unofficial Super Bowl. Like the few dozen others convulsing throughout this University of Kansas flophouse, Stevie, an ebullient 20-year-old with a short brown bob, had been practicing two sleepless nights for the match between her team, Impulse 9, and their rivals, who had driven 8 hours from Michigan, the Ruthless Bastards. Their contests were part of the burgeoning international subculture of clans, organized groups of gamers who played and lived Quake. Like those of the hundreds of thousands of other Quake addicts, their wars were usually over the internet. But on this tornado gray day in Lawrence, Kansas, the country's best were settling the score in the flesh. On one level, such passion came down to the beautiful nightmare of the game itself. Despite id's internal problems during the game's development, Quake was heralded for its breakthrough graphics and visceral experience. USA Today gave Quake 4 out of 4 stars, calling it bloody amazing. A reviewer for Computer Gaming World gave it 10 out of 10, saying it was a towering programming feat that goes beyond immersive to make you feel like you're there in a combat environment. Entertainment Weekly said, Quake delivers the most carnage you can revel in without having to deal with actual jail time. No wonder bored office workers across the country love it. Even the actor Robin Williams praised Quake on the David Letterman show. Though gamers enjoyed the single-player experience, hunting down monsters through the twisting 3D mazes, what they really enjoyed was Deathmatch. As the first game designed specifically for multiplayer team competition over the internet, it allowed up to 16 people to compete in paintball-like teams, hunting each other down in a wild panic to kill or be killed. Football with guns, as a player named Dr. Rigor Mortis put it. In addition to competing over the internet, gamers schlepped their computers to each other's homes and wired them together into a local area network, or LAN, so they could fight in person. These so-called LAN parties, which began casually with Doom, became the offline social nexus for the online gaming world. Within days of Quake's release, fans in chat channels and news groups began forming clans with names like The Breakfast Club, The Revolting Cox, Impulse 9, and The Ruthless Bastards. By August, there were about 20 clans with up to 20 players each. 2 months later, there were close to 1,000. A group of women calling themselves the Clan Widows started a webpage support group. It was the dawn of cybersports. And it didn't take long for the moguls to cash in. Electronic games are the extreme games of the mind, said an entrepreneur behind a chain of virtual reality arcades in New York, Chicago, and Sydney. So let's bring the cyber athletes into arenas and elevate this to a spectator sport. Big screens, Quake matches networked from around the world, beer, prizes, the works. His prediction of star players competing with Nike logos tattooed across their knuckles wasn't crazy. One clan, Dark Requiem, hustled a webpage ad from a joystick maker. Thresh, winner of the Judgment Day tournament, received a sponsorship from Microsoft. The kids who were always the last ones picked in gym class lineup could be the next Michael Jordans. Michael Jordans, who might look something like Fook, the co-leader of the Ruthless Bastards. The 27-year-old with a tiny soul patch beard led his clan to the top of the Clan Ring League, a feat accomplished by only one other team at that point, Impulse 9. Since Quake's debut, Fook had been spending his evenings in East Lansing, Michigan, buried in his parents' basement. A windowless, computer game Mission Control, filled with twisted piles of joysticks and keyboards, mammoth speakers, a scattering of NBA video game cartridges. The only art on the walls was a black velvet portrait of Jesus, which Fook found funny because the nose resembled the edge of a double-barreled shotgun, one of the weapons in Quake. Video game images had been burning into Fook's consciousness ever since Space Invaders, he said, first melted my mind. At the time, Fook was just Clint Richards, a competitive new kid on the block escaping into the fantasy worlds of sci-fi novels and the Atari 2600. After seeing Star Wars a few dozen times, he decided his life's ambition, to fly to other planets and battle aliens. Contrary to most kids, he never gave up. Following a stab at rock god fantasy in a disco punk band called Shampoop, Clint found a more stimulating environment to live out his childhood dream, Quake. Using the handle _F0K, pronounced Fook, a satire of self-conscious hacker TypeScript, and a high-speed modem hustled from his job,